Audible Studios presents The Ratstone Serenade, written by Denzel Myrick, performed by David Monteith. Prologue. 100 years ago, Blan, near Kinloch. Torquil Drysdale, lawyer and notary public from Kinloch, arrived on the back of Tam Murray's farm cart. The old farmer stuck out his hand, a knowing look on his face, as Drysdale fumbled in his pocket and fished out a few coins, with a sigh.
"Kindly wait here for me to conclude my business, Mr. Murray." "Aye, I will that, sir. But you know fine that'll mean mere coin."
He sniffed, then rubbed his nose along the length of a grubby sleeve.
"If you mean more than I've already given you, then yes, I'm well aware, Mr. Murray. Just wait here."
The lawyer brushed dirt and loose straw from his suit as he walked from the cart. He could hear a hammer clanging on metal in the distance, so followed the noise around the corner of the whitewashed house. Before him was a gravel yard, around which three open-ended buildings clustered. In the middle stood a massive Clydesdale horse, chewing on hay, as a large man bent over a plate-sized hoof hammering in a new horseshoe.
"Mr. Stewart!" shouted Drysdale.
Though the blacksmith kept to his task, he raised a hand to show that he had heard. In a few moments he stopped to examine the job, then stood stiffly, turning to face the lawyer.
"And just who are you?"
he said, wiping his huge hands down the front of his greasy leather apron.
"I'm Torquil Drysdale of Perrott, Drysdale and McCormack in Kinloch. We're the lawyers who sent you the letters you've been ignoring, Mr. Stewart."
He held out his hand to shake Stewart's, but the big man didn't move.
"If this is anything to do with Archibald Shannon, I'm not interested." "It's nothing to do with whether you're interested or not," replied Drysdale, eyeing the hammer in Stewart's meaty fist. "The law is the law. You sold this property to Mr. Shannon over 5 years ago, and now he wants to use the land for something else. You have to leave, Mr. Stewart."
Drysdale pulled at the tight collar of his shirt and swallowed, his mouth dry. He was much happier in court or behind his desk in Kinloch. However, he'd drawn the short straw, and the job of serving court papers to Nathaniel Stewart was his responsibility.
"This is from the Sheriff Court in Kinloch, Mr. Stewart. You have exactly 1 calendar month from today to remove yourself from the premises."
He reached into the inside pocket of his jacket and handed the big youthful blacksmith a folded document, fastened with a red wax seal. Stewart looked down at the piece of paper and shrugged his broad shoulders, knots of muscle rippling in his thick arm as he lifted his hand to point into the distance.
"My people have lived here for hundreds of years, maybe thousands. We were here before the Lords of the Isles, who resided in the castle that used to sit at the top of that rock over there,"
he said, pointing down the steep hill and along the beach to a distant promontory of land.
"Before Kinloch was a toon, before the Regians came o'er the sea and called our country Scotland. Aye, and I tell you something, right here's where we're going to stay." "That's as may be, Mr. Stewart, but you signed the deeds over to Mr. Shannon. Surely you must remember doing this. The transaction was witnessed by my own office." "I remember fine, but Archie Shannon has reneged on his side of the agreement." "There is nothing at all in the document signed by you and he that mentions anything that has not been taken into consideration by the court. This is a straightforward transaction, Mr. Stewart. You sold the land to Mr. Shannon and were given leave at his discretion to rent the property back, which you have done these past 5 years."
"Aye, and should be able to the next 50 years, and then a further 50, if those that come after me wanted to,"
growled Stewart, prompting Drysdale to take a step back.
"No, Mr. Stewart, that is most certainly not the case. As owner of the land, Mr. Shannon has the right to ask you to leave this property after a notice period of 1 year has elapsed. That year is almost up. He told me that we could live here for as long as we wanted. We shook hands on it.
All he asked of me was to pay the due rent, which I have done every quarter, just like he asked.
Drysdale shuffled his feet nervously.
Whatever Mr. Shannon may have said to you is not part of the written agreement, Mr. Stewart. We've been through this in our communications. When Mr. Shannon allegedly said this to you, who witnessed it?
Drysdale's voice was croaky now because of his dry mouth.
Me! I witnessed it!
Shouted Stewart, his grip tightening around the handle of his hammer.
Then I'm afraid that is of no consequence. Frankly, Mr. Stewart, I'm surprised that Mr. Shannon has let you run your business from here for so long. Two blacksmiths in the one village can't be good for business. Aye, well, we were here first, and forbye, he's no a blacksmith. His feyther and grandfeyther, aye, not him. That's not important, Mr. Stewart. He owns the business, and quite a few others in Kinloch, Glasgow, and beyond. You have no choice. You have 1 month to take your leave, or sheriff officers will remove you. Do you understand? Mr. Shannon intends to build his new home here.
He gazed out at the scene below.
And I, for one, don't blame him, despite the climb to get up here.
Suddenly Stewart lurched at the smaller man, catching him by the throat.
"Do you know who my people are, Mr. Drysdale?"
he said, sending flecks of spittle over the lawyer's face.
"I've heard it said you are of the Tinker community. I don't see what—"
"If I am forced to leave this land, I will curse Archibald Shannon and all of his family now and forevermore. Every 50 years, to mark the promise broken to me, calamity will befall his family. Aye, until the end of time. Do you understand?"
He pushed Drysdale onto the ground and stood over him.
"Go back to Kinloch and tell Archibald Shannon that."
Drysdale scrambled up and ran back around the corner and onto Murray's cart.
"Move, Mr. Murray, and don't spare the whip!"
"Come on, old girl," shouted Murray, calmly lifting the reins. "As for the whip, well, that'd be a lot more coin," he added,
as the cart moved slowly off, the large figure of Nathaniel Stewart watching it go. The beach at Blan, near Kinloch. He loved this beach, even though it was always winter, always cold when he was here. He watched a gull riding the wind above the green storm-tossed sea, as though dangling from a string like the model planes on the ceiling of his bedroom in London. Sometimes he could see ships on the horizon, but not today. The sky was slate-grey. At the far end of the stretch of fine yellow sand, the promontory thrust out into the sea like a rocky finger. He'd always imagined it had the head of a lion, big and bold. His father told him stories of the castle that had once sat on the cliff-top, facing the cold depths fearlessly from its tall perch. The boy was bewitched by thoughts of the olden days, to think that his ancestors had once lived there, on the high rock, in a time when men had swords and fought battles. Now there were only a few stones left, an earthly reminder of times past. When he had asked how many men their ancestor had in his castle, conjuring up in his mind the kings and princes he had read about in books and seen on trips to the big cinema in Kensington, his father had smiled indulgently.
"We weren't rich then, Archie. We fought for the clan chief, but we were strong and fierce."
When Archie looked towards the other end of the beach, up to the high cliff on which the great house stood solid and indomitable, he couldn't imagine his family having ever been anything else but rich. He'd seen some children begging in the streets near home just before Christmas. His mother told him they were poor. He studied one miserable little boy with a dripping nose and in ragged clothes, and decided that he never wanted to be poor. Up at the big house, he could see his mother on the terrace from time to time, no doubt checking that he hadn't strayed too near the sea. Like him, she was wrapped up against the cold. He wanted to play a trick on her. He looked around. There, between two dunes, A small burn trickled over soft sand. As he followed its course backwards, away from the sea, he could no longer see the cliff, the house, or his mother. His young mother shivered as she looked out from the terrace and to the beach below. She breathed deeply. The cool, moist air was so fresh, so different from London. Glancing at her watch, and deciding it was time that both she and the boy were out of the cold, she looked for her son. She had seen Archie what seemed only moments before as he skipped and played on the sand, but she was dismayed to note that, so engrossed had she been in her novel, more than 20 minutes had now elapsed since she had last checked on him. Now, there was no sign. She rushed to the balcony railing, a slight dizziness making her aware of the sheer drop on the other side. Leaning out as far as she dared, she could see nothing of her son on the beach, or the steep path that snaked up the cliff towards the mansion that loomed behind her.
"Archie! Archie!"
she called, her heart pounding, face stinging against the cold. Some primeval instinct was pricking her. She craned her neck out further, terrified that she would see her son struggling in the crashing surf. But there was no one there, and the cold green sea went about its relentless business. The boy stopped in his tracks. When he looked back, he could still see the beach between the cleft of the large dunes. But as he made his way along the burn, the grey light seemed to darken, and the sound of the waves grew muffled, as though he had his woolen bobble hat pulled over his ears. The smells were different, too. The salty tang of the sea gave way to something earthier, a rotting smell, like on his father's compost heap. He wrinkled his nose. This was the stench of something old, something decaying. Startled by a faint rustling noise, he looked ahead.
"Hello?"
he called, his voice dampened by the rough clumps of machar that clung to the sides of the dunes.
"Oh!"
There, only a few feet in front of him, stood a figure, still and silent, dressed like the monks he had seen on holiday in Italy. The hood of the man's dirty white cloak covered his bowed head.
"Hello, I'm Archie Shannon,"
the boy said, accustomed to meeting strangers and raised to be polite. He turned around, wishing he could see the cliff, the big house, and, most of all, his mother. Was this one of the boys from the village he'd played with on holidays? It was too big. There was something intriguing about the hooded figure, something that compelled him to take a few steps closer. Chapter 1 The Present Day, Kinloch. The little boy was on the couch, only feet away from Daly.
"Come on, James," he encouraged. "Say Dada."
James Daly smiled at his father, gurgling. Daly gave him an exaggeratedly eager look, leaning further towards him, grinning broadly.
"Dada," he repeated.
The little boy appeared to think about this, gurgled, and then burped, laughing. Reflections of the fairy lights on the large Christmas tree twinkled in his bright eyes. Daly picked him up and stood at the window of the bungalow high on the hill above Kinloch, looking out across the bay. Trees swayed in the strong wind, and despite being sheltered from the storm-tossed sound by the island at its head, the loch shimmered with white-tipped waves. As he bounced his son in his arms, he realized that he would miss this place and its people. He had made friends here, good ones, and there was something cheering about waking up to the beautiful view every day, seeing the seasons change, the mood of the landscape altering to suit the weather. A vista that was cold and forbidding could be transformed by a sudden beam of winter sun shining bright through the clouds, turning this far-flung part of the west coast of Scotland into a scene reminiscent of an expansive alpine lake. He sighed as his gaze caught the line of white crosses that paraded straight and true along the hillside opposite. The dead of war were as they had been in life, in rank and file, shining bright above Kinloch Cemetery, despite the gloom of the day. He saw the faces of those he had known, the fallen from his own time. But his sudden melancholy was fleeting as he looked back into the eyes of his son, the image of his mother's, cornflower blue under sleepy, slanting lids. He was still jiggling the boy on his knee, telling him a meandering tale of kings and princes, when he heard a car crackle on the stone chips of the driveway and stop near the house. He did not bother getting up. He didn't want to. He knew who was coming to call. The door to the lounge swung open, revealing Liz, brushing away a loose strand of hair from her brow, her hands white with the flour she was baking with, her latest obsession.
"Didn't you hear the door, darling? Honestly, this is Chief Superintendent Symington. You knew she was coming."
From behind Liz, a shorter woman appeared, resplendent in full uniform, the gold braid on her hat catching the lights in the room and glowing in response.
"Good morning, DCR Daly. I'm sorry to disturb your time off. As I said on the phone, I wanted to introduce myself away from the office. I'm sure you understand," she said.
Though short in stature, even at this brief exposure, she exuded self-assurance. Liz grabbed James Daly, Jr., made her excuses, and left them to it. Daly studied his new, if very temporary, boss as she sat on the chair opposite. She had removed her hat to reveal short, dark hair. A sallow complexion framed her keen, dark eyes, thin nose, and full mouth. Despite her Mediterranean looks, she spoke with a soft English accent, which, though he didn't know why, surprised him. She was slim, straight-backed, and immaculately turned out, in a uniform that spoke more of Hugo Boss than it did of the police service's tailor. Daly reckoned that she was probably in her mid-thirties, though he had always found it difficult to put an age on police women in uniform, strange for one who had spent so much time around them. There was something about a uniform that aged people, especially the fairer sex, in his opinion. He reasoned, though, given her exalted position, she could hardly be any younger.
"I trust you had a nice Christmas," she said, sitting forwards in her chair.
"Yes, yes, I did, thanks," Daly replied, suddenly conscious of the fact that he hadn't said anything so far. He stood and held out his hand, which she shook, her grip surprisingly strong. Daly sat back down. "The wee man's first Christmas. Always special."
"Yes, I'm sure. Not something I know much about."
Daly could hear Brian Scott's "married to the job" maxim echo in his head.
"Well, you know why I'm here, DCI Daly. I won't try to dress it up."
"No point."
"Indeed. You have, what, 3 weeks of your notice left to work, am I right?"
Correct. Well, 23 days to be exact."
"I must tell you that our senior executive officers are still most unhappy with your decision to quit the job. In fact, the chief constable himself has urged me to personally ask you to stay. That's why I'm here, in fact."
"Really?" Daly thought for a moment. "But what do you think?" She paused and pursed her lips.
"In all honesty, from a personal point of view, I'm of the opinion that if an officer becomes so disenchanted with the police service that he or she contemplates taking early retirement, with all that entails, it's unlikely that they have the correct mindset to contribute effectively. However, I know that this is not an opinion shared by my superiors."
"Thank you for your candour," he said, noticing her take a quick look at her watch. She'd done what she came to do. Now she wanted to be on to the next job.
"Do you have anything lined up? For the future, I mean."
It was his turn to hesitate. He and Liz had argued long and hard about the future. She couldn't understand why her husband, having attained a reasonably high rank with prospects of further promotion, had decided to quit his job. For his part, despite being convinced that life as a police officer was no longer for him, he was at a loss to think of anything else he wanted or was qualified to do, save the usual options of security consultant or such like. In any event, the best and most lucrative of these roles were normally the preserve of retirees from the top of the tree, not its middle branches.
"Oh, I have a few irons in the fire," he replied, less than convincingly.
"I would have thought that a man who has just started a family, albeit late in life, would have been looking for security of employment. But there you are, nowt so funny as folk," she continued, revealing more of her accent, probably from Yorkshire, Daly surmised. "All this aside, however, It is my task to inform you that you would be in line for a permanent appointment as subdivisional commander should you decide to stay. No immediate advancement in rank, but certainly a greater prospect of such in the very near future. Despite the offer, Daly had the feeling that Chief Superintendent Symington was merely going through the motions.
Are you Donald's direct replacement?
If you are referring to the late Chief Superintendent John Donald, then yes, I am.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
She looked about the room.
Your wife has good taste.
How do you know I'm not responsible for the decor?
I've read your file, DCI Daly. That's how I know. Anyway, I've imparted the information as requested. I'll leave you to the rest of your festivities. You're back at work tomorrow, I'm right in saying.
Yes, Hogmanay.
Good. I'll see you then.
Symington shook his hand again as he showed her out of the front door. She didn't look back as she got into her waiting car, which took her back down Daly's Drive, towards Kinloch.
"Darling, I so wish you would change your mind," said Liz, her son on her hip.
"So you are listening?"
"Of course," she replied, handing him the child. "We'd better hope I get better at this baking lark. Looks like I might end up doing it full time."
She looked down, then smoothed the front of her jeans. Daly's heart sank as thoughts of another woman filled his head. Chapter 2 Blan. The Reverend Ignatius Moore puffed his way up the hill. He could see his church, small, neat and well-maintained, nestled in the valley below, and despite himself, his heart soared with pride. The road from here back to his roots in the Australian outback was a long one. From rough stockman to a man of the cloth, a minister in the Church of Scotland, it was something he could never have imagined. His wife, as usual, was much further up the hill than he, at the top of the rise almost. It was at times like this that the 20 years between them told. Mind you, he reasoned, she kept herself so fit it was unlikely he would have kept up with her even if their ages coincided. Soon they were both standing at the peak of the hill, looking down over a glade of oak trees and out across the sea, the loom of the island of Ireland a grey shadow in the distance. The festive season was his busiest time of the year, and he appreciated the opportunity to get away from preaching and sermon-writing to commune with God in the way he preferred. Out, under the heavens, bathing in the glory of all before him.
"Shall we turn back, or do you fancy going down to the woods?" she asked,
her Irish accent lilting on the breeze. He looked at his watch. "Yes, I have loads of time before I have to get ready for tonight's service. Why not?" This was the second last day of the old year, the day before Hogmanay, and, being a Sunday, his flock would be expecting their evening service. He had to admit he'd been surprised how pagan parts of the Christmas holiday had clung on here, not only in the village and its surrounding farms, but also in Kinloch, the town only 10 miles or so away. It was strange to think that, easily within living memory, the people of South Kintyre had worked as normal on Christmas Day, then had their holiday and exchanged gifts on Nair Day, as they called the first day of a new year. When he'd first come to the UK from Australia, he'd been fearful that he would be somewhat out of place in this modern, up-to-the-minute society. He'd detected something else, though, especially in the more remote parts of Scotland. Something old, something unseen and unspoken, but ever-present nonetheless. People were still reluctant to let red-haired folk cross their threshold in the first hours of the new year. Folk memory from a long time ago, when the sight of red-haired people in this part of the world meant death and destruction. It was strange how the tradition had persisted. "As long as you don't tell my church elders I've been down at the Ratstown," he said to her with a smile.
"I wouldn't dare. Sure wouldn't they be astonished that we made it back alive?"
"I imagine they would. Mind you, so would most of my parishioners."
"I'm sure we'll be fine. Come on, time's not for waiting."
She heaved the straps of her rucksack higher onto her shoulders, and set off down towards the oaken glade, with the ancient stone at its heart. Strath na Dreav, the Vale of the Druids. There followed the familiar traipse through boggy ground that sucked at his walking boots, leaving cloying mud on his gaiters, then up onto the little plateau with its circle of trees. He'd been here a handful of times before, and on each occasion had felt strangely disconcerted as he set foot amongst the old, gnarled oaks. It was the opposite feeling to being in a holy place, where the silence soothed and spoke of goodness and peace. Here, though there was quiet, there was no peace. The silence seemed to threaten. He stopped in his tracks. The wind was getting up, and with it a wail, a moan almost, whistled through the ancient grove. The Ratstone Serenade, the old song of the trees. Local tradition had it that the trees were wailing for the past, for older, darker days, and all those that inhabited them. He shivered, wishing they had opted to cut their walk short at the top of the hill.
"Ignatius, quickly!"
His wife's shout was short and anxious. As the whine through the trees became louder, he hurried towards her. He tripped and fell over the knotted root of an old tree that twisted from the ground like the curls of a serpent.
"Iggy!"
He got back up and half-limped, half-ran towards her, anxious now, hearing panic in her voice.
"Look!"
she said, almost in tears, as she pointed to a flat slab of granite, an oblong about the length of a tall man but twice as broad.
"Oh, my!"
Fear constricted his throat. There, arranged in perfect anatomical order, lay a skeleton, the bleached white bones stark against the black stone. By their size, the remains of a child. Having spoken to his new boss already that day, Daly hadn't expected to hear her voice on the other end of the line when he picked up the phone. Now he was in a rickety old Land Rover with Superintendent Symington and a young DC, as they made their way across a rutted field. As the vehicle jolted them along, the farmer it belonged to, Charlie Galbraith at the wheel, Daly reflected on yet another day off spoiled by a recall to work. Not for much longer, he reassured himself.
"Am I right in thinking you're English?"
asked Galbraith, turning in his seat to look at Symington.
"And that's important, why?"
she replied, staring straight ahead.
"Ach, you know how it is with us Scots, missus. Rightly or wrongly, we don't always see eye to eye with Sassenachs. That's all I'm saying, mind." "We're not far away now, are we, Charlie?"
Daly asked, trying to shut the elderly man up.
"Bloody dark already." "Aye, dark in mair ways than one, Mr. Daly. This land has been in our family for generations. I grew up here, aye, and I spent my life right here on this farm, but I'll tell you something. I've only been amongst they old oak trees a handful of times."
"Really? In your whole life?"
inquired Symington, suddenly interested in what he had to say.
"Aye, and it's many years since I was last there, tay."
"Oh, well, this'll be a nice change for you,"
she replied, not without a hint of sarcasm.
"No, not for me,"
he said, bringing the Land Rover to a halt.
"I would rather cut out my ain eyes than go up there to the stone. This is as far as I'm going."
He folded his arms across his chest.
"You aren't being serious."
"I am indeed, madam. In any event, there's no way this old thing would make it up the rise. From here, you're on foot. Aye, and on your own, tay."
Daly shone the heavy torch along the ground in front of him, anxious to avoid tripping over the tree roots that thrust from the terrain like the gnarled fingers of an old woman. He heard Symington curse as she tripped, and turned to see her being hauled up by the large and more than capable figure of D.C. Wilkinson. Daly was used to death. Its cloying stench had followed him throughout his years as a police officer. From the pensioner lying dead of cold in a Glasgow multi-story, to the gangster face down in a pool of his own blood, he had seen it all. But rather than become inured to it, each time he looked into the glazed eyes of a corpse, he pictured them shining bright with the vitality that had been taken away. These were people robbed of something more important than all the wealth in the world, their own existence. Yet another melancholy thought he hoped would disappear with his police ID.
"What a bloody racket!"
shouted Symington above the whine of the wind through the trees.
I hope we haven't got much further to go."
There was indeed an eerie moan. High-pitched, it echoed through the trees.
"No, nearly there,"
replied Daly, seeing the flash of a torch up ahead. Soon they reached a clearing where three figures stood, huddled into their coats.
"Hello, sir. Sorry to drag you out, but I thought you'd better see this right away,"
said Pollock, the middle-aged, thick-set constable whose rural beat covered Blan, and who had been the first to respond to the call.
"It's like nothing I've ever seen before, sir,"
he continued, his salt-and-pepper moustache bristling. Daly stepped closer to the couple, who were entwined in an embrace, their breath rising in clouds. The man was tall, but only slightly more so than the woman, who was wide-eyed and upset, her head leaning on his shoulder. By the lines on his face, Daly saw that he was older than his female companion. He'd heard of Ignatius Moore, the minister at Blan Church, though he hadn't met him. He remembered the rumour and innuendo in Kinloch when he had taken a new and much younger wife. Recollections of a young woman nervously pressing the front of her skirt flashed through his mind again. He banished the thought.
"Reverend Moore, I'm Jim Daly. Sorry to have kept you here. I came as quickly as I could."
In fact, thought Daly, he was surprised that Pollock hadn't sent the couple home out of the cold once he had arrived on the scene.
"Hello, Mr. Daly. I've heard about you. All good, of course," said Moore, his Australian accent strong. "This is my wife, Veronica."
Daly shook the woman's gloved hand.
"Pleased to meet you, though I wish the circumstances were different, Mrs. Moore. Let's have a look at what you found."
"Oh, it's horrible, Mr. Daly," she said. "Just horrible."
Daly shone his torch down to the dark slab at their feet. It was only knee-high, but long, approximately rectangular in shape. The bright white bones stood out on its black surface, all in order, as he'd been told. The neat little skull was on his left, the thin bones of the feet to the right.
"Let's get you back out of the cold, and we can talk," said Daly, seeing Mrs. Moore shiver.
"May I inquire why you left these good people out here to freeze in the first place, Constable?"
asked Symington. Pollock shifted from one foot to the other.
Well, ma'am, I wasn't just sure how you would like to proceed. I mean, it's not every day we come across something like this."
"Oh, please don't blame the constable," said Reverend Moore. "We weren't about to leave him here alone."
As he spoke, the wind whined louder through the trees.
"Not the kind of place anyone should be alone, I reckon."
As Symington and the Moores picked their way by torchlight through the glade of oaks back to the Land Rover, Daly took the chance to speak to P.C. Pollock. "I'll leave D.C. Wilkinson with you until Socco and the rest of the troops arrive. I want to interview the minister and his wife at home. You know the score. Maintain the integrity of the locus, etc. I'll be back to see how the team are getting on." Daly hesitated.
"Are you okay, Willie?"
"Aye," he paused. "As you know, sir, I'm not one for romancing. None of this bloody fanciful stuff. A spade is a spade as far as I'm concerned. But I'm not ashamed to say, well, there's something about this place. Come on, Willie, I expect that kind of thing from old Charlie Galbraith, not you." "Aye, easy to say, not so easy today, sir."
He looked down at the small skeleton.
"Who's going to tell the Shannons about this?"
"The Shannons? What do they have to do with it?"
"You'll recall, sir, that every year the Shannon family hold their AGM up at Kersevay House. Remember how you had me detailed there over Hogmanay last year? You know, at the gate, sir."
"Ah, yes. The superintendent's idea, not mine, if I remember rightly," replied Daly,
recalling Donald's obsession at getting everything just right as far as the Shannon family were concerned. Was that really only a year ago? So much had changed.
"You might remember that they suffered a family tragedy back in the 60s, sir."
"Vaguely. I think I've read something about that, now you mention it."
"Aye. A wee boy, about 6 when he disappeared. Never saw hide nor hair of him again, apart from his left shoe lying on the beach."
He shone his torch down on the black stone.
"I'm no pathologist, but that's the skeleton of a child, sir. And the way the bones are bleached, well, they'll look old, in my book, anyway."
Daly stared at the little skull. He knew something of the Shannon family case. knew that they were a very rich family and that Pollock was right, as far-fetched as it may seem, to flag up a possible connection between the bones laid out in front of them and the family who visited the Clifftop Mansion once a year. It looked as though the last few weeks of his police career were not destined to be as calm as he'd hoped. Chapter 3 The man stood at the edge of the village, on the road back to Kinloch. Having been driven back across the field by the indelicate farmer Galbraith in his Land Rover, Symington and the Moors had swapped vehicles. Symington's exceptionally clean police car, complete with driver, was now parked on the gravel driveway outside the solid Georgian house. Daly raised a hand in farewell as Galbraith reversed back down the driveway. He chapped at the large brass knocker, and the Reverend Moore opened the door.
"D.C.R. Daly, do come in out of the cold," he said, ushering the detective into the warm hallway.
Daly noted the paintings of local beauty spots jostling for space with photographs on the walls as he walked into the wood-panelled lounge, a blazing fire at its heart. Veronica stood elegantly, her back to the flames, while Superintendent Symington perched on the edge of a Chesterfield couch. After the usual pleasantries and the offer of a glass of whisky that Daly regretfully declined, Moore made his apologies and left the room to change, in readiness for the evening service. He would, he reassured Symington, only be a few minutes, following which he would be able to answer any questions she and Daly might have for him. Left alone with Symington and Daly, Veronica launched into conversation. It turned out that she and her husband walked most days, taking in the beautiful scenery around Blan, as well as helping the new Mrs. Moore meet her husband's flock out with the confines of the church.
"I've come to realise that the life of a minister's wife is much more involved than I had expected, Mr. Daly," she said, nursing a glass of wine. "I've never been involved with so many groups and societies. All great fun, though, and the people here are just lovely."
"So you haven't come across any resentment?"
asked Symington, rather brusquely, Daly thought.
"I mean, you are clearly a few years younger than your husband. I know how difficult certain elements of small rural communities can be about that sort of thing. I'm from one myself."
Daly wondered if his new boss had inadvertently given something of herself away by that remark. Certainly he detected a momentary look of regret on her face.
"Oh, you and me both, Superintendent," replied Veronica. "This place isn't all that different to the village in Ireland where I grew up. The same obsession with gossip, for one. But sure, don't we all have our own faults? In the main, people are nice and kind. Iggy works hard, and I think folk appreciate that."
"Iggy?" asked Daly with a smile.
"I know. Iggy, short for Ignatius. I love the man, but not his name, Mr. Daly. Of course, I daren't call him that in front of the parishioners. It would cause nothing short of a riot. They'd probably take me down to the Rat Stone and—"
"What do you know about this Rat Stone?" asked Daly.
Just what I've been told, mainly by the older members of our congregation. It's ancient, I know that. The Vale of the Druids, if you please. Old Jock would be able to tell you more. He's a retired writer, lived here for most of his life, and loves the history of Blan. It was him that first took me to see the stone."
The lounge door swung open.
"One of the very few local people who will go anywhere near the place," said Moore, now decked out in his vestments. "Lovely guy. There's nothing about Blan he doesn't know."
He stood beside his wife, putting his arm around her waist.
"Strange how traditions maintain in this country. I found it so odd when I first came here. In Australia, we've all kind of lost touch with our roots. Leave all that ancestor stuff to the Aborigines. Not that there's anything wrong with that, you know," he added hurriedly, after a look from his wife.
"What traditions are you talking about?" asked Daly.
"Oh, you know, all that ancient magic stuff, paganism, a certain way of doing things. Fascinating if you study it. Dates back to the sun worship of prehistory. Little quirks still persist, like never clockwise, always anti-clockwise. Widdershins, they call it."
"Fascinating, I'm sure," observed Symington.
"Yeah, it is. Do you know, they don't come to church here.
they still go to the stone.
I thought nobody went there, said Daly, momentarily confused.
Oh, it's to the church they come, but that's what they say. It's an echo of what used to happen. Clearly the Rat Stone was the centre of worship here long before Christianity was even heard of.
Veronica's face darkened.
Though I'm not sure that worship is the right way to describe it. Evil, pure evil, went on there. Human sacrifice, that's what the Druids were all about.
Oh, don't listen to her. The Druids were devoted to learning, healing, protecting the environment, said Moore. My wife finds it hard to leave her old profession behind sometimes.
I'm sure no one is interested in that, she said, glaring at the minister. Why not?
Asked Symington. Veronica raised her eyes to the ceiling.
Once upon a time I was a nun. I spent 8 years of my life locked away from the world. It was a long time ago, but as you can see, I saw the light and decided to carry on God's work out in the open, in the community rather than hidden from it. The Druids might have been the first eco-warriors my husband describes, but if you crossed them or formed part of their rituals, well, you weren't in a good place, we know that much.
Old habits die hard, is that not right, my dear?
Ha ha,
she replied, her smile thin.
Seriously, though, there's something about that stone. It draws you in. It's like the feeling you get when you stand too near to the edge of a cliff. You feel that you want to jump. She looked straight at Daly. There's no good there. No good at all. Everyone can feel it. It pulls at you.
And you, Reverend Moore, you're a long way from home. Why choose to be a minister here? Asked Daly.
Oh, I love it. Dream come true, in fact. Mind you, if I were to stand here and bore you with all the twists and turns my life's taken, I'd miss the service tonight, and probably the one after that, too.
So you didn't enjoy your pastoral work in Australia? Asked Symington.
Oh, yeah, I mean, for the short time I was there. I only worked as a man of the cloth at home for a couple of years. Spent my earlier life drifting, you know. I've been a stockman, sheep shearer, tour guide, you name it.
So why the church? Asked Daly. Moore smiled.
I had an epiphany, if you like. No heavenly trumpets, choirs, or golden visions, but I woke up one morning after a night on the grog. We'd been taking 1,000 head of cattle over to new grazing in the Northern Territories. It was hot, dusty work, so we all enjoyed a coldie of an evening. Me more than most. He grimaced. I'll never forget it. I woke up under a blanket, just as it was getting light. The sun was rising, but the stars, billions of them, still in the part of the sky that was black.
He paused, looking up as though he could still see them glinting.
I watched as the sun slowly washed those stars out, and I could feel its warmth on my face. Something happened. I don't know what. Suddenly, I just knew that there was something else, something bigger. You know what I mean?
He looked at Daly and Symington with a smile.
And you ended up here. Happy? Asked Daly.
Yep, and never regretted it. I had a pretty rough time as a kid. My father was handy with his fists, especially when he'd had a tinny or two, which was most nights.
Is that not something you have in common with him? Enjoying a drink, I mean? Asked Symington.
No, not at all.
Moore's tone was pleasant, though Daly recognised a flash of irritation on the minister's face.
Back in my stockman days, yes, everyone drank. I like a glass or two, but that's where the similarity ends. In any case, my father and I didn't share any genetics, Superintendent. I was adopted as a youngster.
What about your real parents? Asked Symington.
My father refused to say, and my mother was too scared to disagree.
He shrugged his shoulders.
Have you ever tried other channels? Symington persisted.
Yeah, I did. Well, half-heartedly, I suppose. Though much good it did me back then. Thousands of orphan kids found themselves adopted by families who used them as slave labour. Nothing else. I was no different.
If you approached the authorities, could they have checked back for you? Asked Daly.
No questions asked in that part of the world back then, Mr. Daly.
A lot of unwanted children from Ireland were shipped down under, and from the UK too, interjected Veronica. As my husband says, treated like cattle, little more than unpaid help until they reached an age that they could do something about it and leave. I'm right, aren't I, darling?
Yep, pretty much. But a bad start to life doesn't mean that the rest of it will be the same. I know that.
Daly thought of some of the children he had come across in the course of his career, many of whom had not been as lucky as the Reverend Moore. A bad start leading to a worse middle and a pitiful end to life. He asked the Moores some further questions, then made his excuses, anxious to find out if the forensic team had arrived to examine the skeleton found on the ratstone. Outside, he was just about to radio in to request that the police Land Rover pick him up, when the manse's front door opened and Symington walked out.
"I want you to come with me to Cursivay House, D.C.I. Daly."
"If you say so, ma'am."
"I want to present a united front. From what I can glean from the files in Kinloch, these Shannons can be bloody difficult. They're real players. The company is still family-owned, and it's one of the biggest private enterprises in the world."
She looked at Daly.
"And in my experience, the more money people have, the more demanding and difficult they can become."
Chapter 4 Ailsa Shannon sat by the window of her top-floor room in Cursivay House. The only light came from the gibbous moon which hung low over the sea, casting a pale thread upon the rippling water. She loved the view from this window, high in the big mansion on its towering cliff, dark and immovable. It felt as though both the house and the sheer granite upon which it perched had been hewn by the forces of time and nature. In her 80th year, she mused on how important this place had been in her life. Faces passed before her mind's eye, some youthful, now grown old, some forever young, frozen for eternity where time had left them. Memories, both good and bad. A Mozart symphony soared in the large room, a suite, really, with a separate bedroom and sitting area. To dispense with the long climb, she had ordered a lift to be installed for her convenience, though for those of more tender years, fleet of foot and heart, the dizzying spiral staircase still corkscrewed down to the ground floor. She felt this mansion was part of her, solid and ever-present, always in the back of her mind. 100 years old, nearly. Cursivay House had been the dream of Archibald Shannon, a dream made real in stone and glass, facing boldly out to sea from the cliff that shared its name. No wind was too strong, no sea too wild to breach its tough facade, a symbol of the family that made it. 100 years ago, it had been a portent of the success that was to come. The success that saw the Shannon family, the descendants of a humble Blan blacksmith, rise to dominate the world of business and commerce. In the shadows cast by the pale moonlight, she noticed that a dark crack had appeared in the high ceiling, splintering down to the top of the wide window frame. As the music faded, the old house creaked and groaned in the quiet cold of the midwinter evening. She thought of her husband, now long dead, the feckless son who now frustrated her so, and the little boy, lost to her long ago. She pictured her in-laws, nieces, nephews, their children, spouses, friends, lovers, her granddaughter, so beautiful, so sensitive, but so troubled. They were all here for another new year. But for how many more? She stared down onto the terrace balcony, which overlooked a stretch of sand upon which the tide lapped cold and dark. In her mind, under a long-ago grey sky, she could still see the little boy with his bobble hat and coat buttoned up to its velvet collar to keep out the cold. A knock at the door broke the spell. "Come in," she called. The solid oak door creaked open, and an old man stepped into the dark room.
"Sorry to disturb you," he said politely,
though his low voice was laced with insincerity and irritation.
"We have visitors."
"We have lots of visitors, Percy. To whom in particular do you refer?"
"The constabulary are here. They want to speak to you."
"Oh, well, please put on some lights, then show them up, if you don't mind." Percy mumbled under his breath as he hobbled around the room, switching on various lights.
"Why are you sitting in the dark?" he asked,
the question more like an accusation.
"Because that's what I want to do. I'm sorry that it doesn't meet with your approval."
She watched him, the room now bright in the lamplight. He was thinner than ever, stooped, the wrinkles on his face highlighted by the white of his hair and sparse goatee beard. Percy was the old family retainer, a throwback to days long gone. He and his plump wife lived in a small cottage in the grounds, one of the few buildings left standing after the old blacksmith's had been demolished to make way for the mansion. He had been a caretaker for more than 60 years. She remembered him when he was young and fit, dark-haired, with a lantern jaw, able to turn his hand to anything, irascible, but with a kind of guileless charm. He had made Kersevay House his life. As caretaker, he had taken his role seriously and performed it well. Accustomed to having the place to themselves, he and his wife had become less and less happy with the annual influx of Shannons as the years went on. But then again, so had Ailsa.
"How old are you now, Percy? I always forget."
"Not in my dotage, as your nephew thinks," he replied testily,
careful not to reveal his age. He had taken a cloth from his pocket and was rubbing at the brass surround of a light switch.
"Honestly, I don't know what people are doing with their hands these days. Finger marks all over the place. I was brought up to wash my hands and not plaster them across everything."
Ailsa smiled as he mumbled on, his attention now taken up by the angle of a lampshade.
"I'm sure the police officers won't mind about that. Please go and fetch them, and take the bloody lift. Climbing that staircase in your mid-80s is bordering on the suicidal."
"I'm in my early 80s," he replied, less than convincingly. "Anyhow, the policeman doesn't look as though he'd make it to the first floor, great gut hanging over his trousers. And for the little bitch he has with him, well, by the sound of it, she's English. Adorned with buttons and braid, like the old king, if you please. Just a wee lassie, too. What good would she be in a fight? I don't understand why they bother with police women."
"Off you go, and try to keep your archaic prejudices to yourself,"
Ailsa chided, as he mumbled his way out of the door. In the lamplight, the crack above the window frame looked longer and deeper. She stared at it, then picked up the business magazine lying at her side. There he was, her nephew, Maxwell Shannon, under the bold headline, "The Rise of the Heir Apparent." She scanned the article once more. After running Shannon International's North American banking operation, Maxwell Shannon's stellar rise in global business seems without limit, as he is poised to take control of the world's largest private company from his ailing father. "I want to begin the process of forming Shannon International for the 22nd century, never mind the 21st, he was quoted as saying. "My vision will see us continue to challenge the largest multinationals, and our dominance in areas of finance, mineral extraction, and technology go from strength to strength." There was an accompanying picture of Maxwell, smiling sickeningly from behind his large desk in the Shard, the lighting angled strategically to minimize the lines around his eyes. She took a deep breath and thought of her own son, Bruce. Were it not for his father's premature death, it would have been he and not his cousin Maxwell being interviewed, struggling behind the scenes to wrest control of the company from the hands of the board. But the two cousins were on opposite poles. Maxwell was ruthlessly focused, Bruce dissolute and self-indulgent. While Maxwell would sell his soul to succeed, her son was more likely to turn over in bed, to sleep on, to hell with business and its exigencies. There was one good thing, though, that she was sure of. Bruce had a good heart. Maxwell was cruel, manipulative, and vindictive, a living embodiment of the very worst qualities of the Shannon family she had been part of for so many years. She gazed at that face again, smiling triumphantly from the glossy pages of the magazine.
"You haven't won yet, nephew."
She put the magazine down and stared at her reflection in the black window, waiting for her visitors to arrive. Hidden from Ilse's view on the beach below, a dark figure emerged from a cleft between the dunes and looked up at the mansion on the cliff, a deep hood obscuring their face. The sea splashed onto the shore, hissing over the shingle on its retreat. A cloud of breath rose from the cloaked figure, illuminated only by the moon. Light flashed off cold steel, held out in front of the hooded face. A soft chant was carried on the light breeze, up from the beach, across the fields, and, gaining strength, through the trees that guarded the rat stone. Brian Scott started the car in his driveway in Kirkintilloch, turning the heater on full blast to melt the ice that obscured his windscreen. He rubbed his hands together and cursed. The night before Hogmanay, and here he was just about to embark on the drive to Kinloch, a journey which was long and arduous enough on a bright summer's day, never mind on a night like this, as the temperature plummeted in tandem with his resolve. Scott was a man with a mission. He had been tasked, by the chief constable no less, with persuading his long-time colleague and best friend, Jim Daly, to withdraw his resignation. He mentally replayed the conversation with his boss of bosses.
"With the greatest respect, sir, when our Jimmy, I mean DCI Daly, has made up his mind, there's bugger all... there's not much you can do to change it."
"Nonsense, DC Scott. If there is one man that Daly listens to, it's you. I've read your files, both of them," he added, staring at Scott from over his narrow spectacles.
"That canny have made pleasant reading,"
mumbled Scott, not intending his superior to hear.
"Indeed it did not,"
observed the chief constable, opening a file on his desk.
"I find here that you've been arrested, mark you, on no less than 4 occasions since joining up." "Aye, well, sir, you'll see that these arrests were proven to be in error," said Scott, nervously clearing his throat. "I wasn't guilty of any crimes, so to speak. Apart from the assault on Inspector Galloway at your office party in Paisley 3 years ago, I think I'm right in saying..." "Och, I mean, passions were running high, sir. And you'll note that bastard..." "That the inspector dropped the complaint no long after." "Not before the late Superintendent John Donald, upon whom we shall not dwell, metaphorically forced his arm up his back to do so, reading between the lines of this report, at least."
Scott grimaced, then looked at the floor.
"Aye, yeah, whatever you say, sir. I also note that you are in receipt of 10 commendations and the Queen's Police Medal for Bravery, D.S. Scott, as well as having been shot twice in the line of duty." "Aye, well, feast and famine we may, sir, if you know what I mean. This is a new force, Brian, and as you know, all has not been plain sailing since the formation of Police Scotland."
He removed his glasses and stared at Scott.
"I am relying on experienced, talented, clever detectives like you and DCI Daly to be the backbone of this new organisation. I want you to help bring on the next generation of police officers, in the way that the previous generation nurtured you."
Scott gulped.
"You look surprised, Brian." No, it's no that. I just can't mind much nurturing going on." "Well, times have changed, and they'll change more and more. I need the likes of you and Daly to be the core of this new force as we establish ourselves as the best crime-fighting institution in the UK. I cannot afford to lose someone like Daly, and I want you to make sure that I don't. Understood?"
Scott watched the ice slip down the windscreen as the heater did its work.
"'Easy to say, no easy today,' he muttered, as he flicked on the windscreen wipers, then jumped as someone knocked on the window. "'Are you trying to give me a heart attack, woman?' he shouted above the noise of the engine.
"'Typical. No, thanks for remembering my sandwiches, or cheerio, dear, I'll miss you,'
said his wife Ella, resplendent in a fake leopard-skin onesie.
"'Oh, aye, thanks,'
replied Scott, as she handed the plastic box of sandwiches through the window. "'Get yourself back in the house.
"'Don't worry, a blast of cold air won't do me any harm.
"'I'm no thinking about that. "'I'm no wanting the neighbours to see you parading about like Catwoman gone to seed. "'Why your Tracy bought you that for Christmas, I'll never know.'
"'You drive safely, you grumpy bastard,'
she said, leaning through the window to kiss him on the cheek.
"'And don't be hitting the bevy as soon as you get down there. "'You've done really well our Christmas. "'Just a couple of beers with your dinner. "'Try and stick to that.'
"'Aye, well, I'll try and keep it down to a dull roar. "'It's no so easy sitting all by yourself in a pokey wee hotel room night after night with nobody to talk to.'
"'You! You with nobody to talk to! Aye, and I'm the Pope.
"'You'll have to hand back your season ticket at Ibrox in that case,'
he smiled. Ella hurried back indoors as he edged the car out of the drive.
"'Bloody Kinloch, here I come,'
he sighed, turning up the car stereo, in the hope that Pink Floyd would make the next few hours pass more quickly.